After a few swings, Nicholas stopped him. "Tiger," he said, grinning. "When I grow up, I want to have a swing as pretty as yours." The Bel Air crowd laughed. Although Nicholas delivered the praise with a touch of self-deprecating humor, it was a rare display of public validation from the game's greatest golfer to the child prodigy who had been anointed his successor. Parents of other kids at the clinic looked at Tiger with a mix of awe, envy, and wonder. Over the next 3 months, as Tiger's freshman year came to a close, he lived up to the hype. At the California High School Championships in May, he outperformed juniors and seniors to win the top individual honors. In June, he won the Los Angeles Junior Championship. In July, despite being one of the youngest in the 15 to 17-year-old age group, he won the Optimist International Junior Golf Championship in San Diego. Then it was on to Bay Hill Country Club in Orlando, where he won the U.S. Junior Amateur Championship, making him the youngest and first black winner in the 44-year history of the event. "Son," Earl told him, "you've done something no black person in the United States has ever done, and you will forever be a part of history." Tiger felt good. His string of machine-like victories during the summer of 1991 had clearly established him as the top junior golfer in the country. In August, the New York Times declared in a bold headline, "Four! Nicholas, beware of teenager!" The story was written by Jamie Diaz, who had moved to the New York Times. "I want to be the Michael Jordan of golf," Tiger told Diaz. "I'd like to be the best ever." Dina Gravel was one of the prettiest girls at Western High. A cheerleader, she had blonde hair, blue eyes, and slender legs. The 16-year-old junior was also a diligent student and a good athlete, playing on the varsity tennis and soccer teams. In her big circle of friends, mainly comprising athletes and cheerleaders, she never intersected with Tiger. She'd never even heard of him. But Tiger certainly noticed her when she ended up in his advanced accounting class at the start of his sophomore year. Although he was a year behind her, they were the top two students in the class. After about a month, the teacher pulled them both aside and asked if they would tutor a classmate who was struggling. At the first session, Tiger said little, deferring to Gravel. When he finally chimed in, he was very good at explaining things. It was obvious that he was smart, but Gravel also recognized that he was different. Unable to quite put her finger on it, she chalked it up to the fact that he was basically a nerd. She figured Tiger would benefit from meeting a few more kids. "Hey, you should come out with us sometime," she said after one of the tutoring sessions. "You know, go to a football game." He wasn't sure what to say. "Have you been to a game?" she asked. "Not really." "Come with us." The invitation triggered some social anxiety. Tiger didn't know the kids Gravel knew. His world was golf, studying, and his close circle of guy friends. He liked it that way. Going to a game with Dina would be uncharted territory, way outside his comfort zone. Yet he liked the fact that one of the best-looking girls in the school was paying attention to him. His buddies would never believe it. On Friday night, he sat with Gravel and her friends in the bleachers. He was 2 months shy of his 16th birthday, and it felt good to be out. Shortly after the opening kickoff, Gravel turned to him. "So what do you do?" she said.
"I golf."
"What's that?"
"Well, it's a sport."
"I know that, but like old people golf, why are you doing that?"
He laughed. "Well, I like it."
"Huh.
And I'm kind of good at it."
She didn't ask any more questions about it, and he didn't elaborate. Gravel had no idea that Woods was a certified star. A week earlier, he had been profiled in People magazine. He was a household name to sports writers from Los Angeles to New York, but he mentioned none of that. Sitting in the stands amid a sea of teenagers on a Friday night, he was perfectly content to be an invisible star. The fact was that, at Western High, Dina Gravel was more famous than Tiger Woods. A couple of weeks later, Gravel invited Tiger to another football game. They arrived together, and when they met up with her friends, one of the girls whispered, "Hey, it's that golf guy." Tiger said nothing and took a seat directly behind Gravel in the bleachers. He didn't know her friends, and he wasn't particularly interested in letting them get to know him. While Gravel talked to them, he watched the game. At one point, she leaned back, resting her arms on his legs and using his knees to support her back while she carried on a conversation with her girlfriends seated on either side of her.
for Woods. It was as if an electric current was flooding through his body. He could barely focus on the game. Afterward, when they were alone, he confided in her.
"I was dying when you touched my legs," he told her. She laughed.
"I just leaned back," she said. The silence that followed said a lot. He had fallen hard for her. It went beyond her being gorgeous. He could talk to her. She listened to him. The fact that he was famous and an elite golfer didn't matter to her. She didn't even know about that side of him. Everyone else he met was interested in him because of his talent. She cared about him as a person. Gravel felt something, too. The more time she spent around him, the more she adored him. He was so different from all the other boys. So many of the jocks were loud, prone to bragging, and constantly showing off. Tiger never said anything to anyone, and he never talked about himself. He didn't try to be popular, she recalled. He didn't try to stick out. He was just a gentleman. He minded his own business and did his own thing. I guess that's what attracted me to him. With the holidays approaching, Gravel invited Tiger to her home to have dinner with her parents. He said yes, but he felt uncomfortable. What was he supposed to say to her parents? He kept his head down for most of the evening, saying very little, but he complimented Mrs. Gravel on her cooking and thanked her for having him over. In the dark about Tiger's golf exploits, Gravel's parents concluded that Tiger was a very shy, polite kid. They told him he was welcome at their home anytime. Shortly after that, Tiger invited Gravel to his home to have dinner with his parents. The moment she entered the house, Gravel was struck by the trophies. They were everywhere, on tabletops, on shelves, even on the floor. There had to be 100 of them, plus they were framed copies of newspaper stories about Tiger. "You were in People?" she asked, amazed. "Have you heard about the time he was on That's Incredible?" Earl asked. She had no idea what he was talking about. Earl played a recording for her. Tiger wasn't interested, but Gravel couldn't believe her eyes. The guy she had developed a crush on had been on national television at age 5? Earl corrected her. Tiger was on national television at age 2. What? Gravel didn't get it. Why hadn't Tiger mentioned any of this to her? There was a lot he hadn't told her about himself. Cotita made a sensational chicken dish for dinner. Tiger had never brought a girl home before, and his mother went out of her way to make Dina feel welcome. After the meal, all Tiger wanted to do was introduce Dina to his new puppy. It didn't take Tiger long to decide that he liked hanging out with Gravel at her house more than being at his house. He started going there after golf practice. More and more, he ate dinner with her parents, and they welcomed him like one of the family. On weekends, he and Gravel would stay up late watching television, and after her parents went to bed, they would make out on the sofa. Tiger celebrated his 16th birthday in Florida. He was there for International Management Group's Orange Bowl Junior Classic. After the tournament, he headed for the home of Mark O'Mara. It was all arranged by IMG agent Hughes Norton and IMG founder Mark McCormick. Both men had been courting Tiger long before most people recognized his potential. Woods realized that he would eventually be represented by IMG. He also knew that it was the biggest, most powerful sports agency in the world of golf, but he didn't know the agency's backstory or the full scope of the arrangement IMG had made with his father. Mark McCormick had been a fiercely competitive golfer at the College of William and Mary in the late 1940s and early 50s. After graduating, he attended Yale Law School and served in the U.S. Army before practicing law in Cleveland. He quickly figured out a way to combine his legal career with his passion for golf. He had been organizing exhibitions for pro golfers when he came up with a bigger and more lucrative idea: negotiating contracts for them. In the late 1950s, the purses on the PGA Tour barely reached $2,000, and it was virtually unheard of for a professional golfer to have a contract with an equipment manufacturer. Golf was a sport played by the rich, but no one looked at it as a sport that was going to make anyone rich. Not until McCormick came along. On January 15, 1959, McCormick convinced 29-year-old golfer Arnold Palmer to sign with him. Palmer had grown up in a mill town in Pennsylvania. Humble, handsome, and charismatic, he was the son of a greenskeeper. In McCormick's mind, Palmer was the ideal golfer to expand the appeal of the game to the middle class. Before long, McCormick had left his law firm and started an agency that he later renamed International Management Group.
He eventually signed Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player and built IMG into a sports agency and marketing juggernaut. With Mark McCormick and IMG handling the contracts and endorsement deals for the biggest names in the game, Cleveland became a destination city in the golf universe. In 1972, Hughes Norton joined IMG. When he arrived, he possessed degrees from Harvard and Yale. He was aggressive and sophisticated and had a reputation for being a tough negotiator. The one thing Norton wasn't known for was his humility. He also had a vindictive streak, and he could be a bully. But McCormick and Norton were exceptional at two things: identifying talent and leveraging that talent into lots of money for IMG. When they first got wind of Tiger Woods, they were convinced that he could revolutionize the game in much the same way Arnold Palmer had done three decades earlier. It's unclear exactly when IMG made its first overture to the Woods family, but Earl Woods once claimed that Hughes Norton entered the picture when Tiger was just 5 years old. In the book, His Father's Son, Earl and Tiger Woods, author Tom Callahan reported that Norton had heard about Tiger when he was a toddler and showed up at the Woods home in Cyprus. Tiger rode his bicycle out front while Earl and Norton talked. "I believe that the first black man who's a really good golfer is going to make a hell of a lot of money," Earl reportedly told Norton. "Yes, sir, Mr. Woods," Norton said. "That's why I'm here." Norton declined to answer any questions about his relationship with the Woods family, but he said in an email that he was with Tiger and his family for 10 years, suggesting that their relationship began in 1988. At that point, Tiger was almost 13. Before his death in 2003, Mark McCormick confirmed that IMG had engaged with Earl Woods while Tiger was young. "I had a number of meetings with his father when Tiger was still an amateur, talking what if this, what if that," McCormick told British journalist Howard Soons, author of The Wicked Game. "You certainly really knew he was someone who was going to be a factor in golf." Much has been written about how the so-called handshake deal between McCormick and Arnold Palmer changed the economics of golf. By the time McCormick and Norton were romancing Earl Woods, however, IMG was an international powerhouse representing hundreds of athletes around the world. The sports agency had advanced well beyond handshakes. Plus, IMG viewed Tiger Woods as potentially bigger than any other athlete represented by the firm. He was far too valuable to risk letting him get away. At the time, the Woods family could not afford the tens of thousands of dollars that were necessary to fund Tiger's extensive amateur travel schedule. According to court records from that time period, Earl's annual income was just over $45,000, and his monthly expenses were in excess of $5,800. Earl was essentially paying for Tiger's travel and tournament expenses with credit cards and what he later referred to as a revolving home equity loan, which he described as money borrowed against the family home each summer, only to be somehow paid back every winter. Bottom line, the family needed money, and IMG provided it in a big way. According to a senior IMG executive who worked with McCormick, in or around the summer of 1991, the agency started paying Earl Woods $50,000 per year as a junior talent scout. That figure squares perfectly with what Earl revealed 2 years later during an interview on ABC's Primetime Live, saying that he was spending $50,000 a year on Tiger's amateur career. IMG Vice Chairman Alistair J. Johnston was the head of IMG's world golf operations in the early 90s. In response to a September 2017 email requesting comment on the $50,000 figure, Johnston replied, "At this stage, I can't confirm details. I know that IMG did provide compensation to Earl Woods to work as a talent scout on the junior golf circuit, but I do, however, recall, because it was very important, that we did indeed discuss with the USGA, who proactively engaged with IMG on this particular arrangement to ensure that the association with Earl Woods did not breach any of their rules or regulations pertaining to Tiger's amateur status." The amount of money IMG stood to make by representing Tiger Woods was potentially record-setting. In that respect, the decision to pay Earl five figures annually to be a talent scout was a modest investment. For his talent scouting, all Earl had to do was deliver one golfer, his son. Everything IMG did was calculated to make sure that happened, including introducing Tiger to Mark O'Meara when Woods was in town for the IMG tournament.
O'Mara resided in Isleworth, a 606-acre gated community within the town of Windermere, about 10 miles west of downtown Orlando. Norton asked O'Mara to spend a little time with Tiger, show him around, play a round of golf. Perhaps they would hit it off. That was the hope, anyway. Tiger was instantly impressed with Isleworth. It was very different from Cyprus. He passed through a security checkpoint to enter. A private police force patrolled the neighborhood. There were about 200 homes, and they were all immaculate. Actor Wesley Snipes and superstars Ken Griffey Jr. and Shaquille O'Neal lived in Isleworth. O'Mara's house was across the street from the golf course, which Arnold Palmer had designed, not far from the clubhouse. It was a lot to like. Tiger played 18 holes with O'Mara. They talked about a range of subjects, and O'Mara gave him some simple advice. "Have fun," he told Tiger. "There's no rush to get to the tour." Afterward, they hung out at O'Mara's home. Tiger spent most of the time talking to Mark's wife, Alicia, regarded as one of the most beautiful wives on the tour, who made Tiger feel at home and introduced him to her two children. It appeared that Mark had a perfect life. He played golf for a living, lived in a beautiful home, and had a gorgeous wife and two cute kids, and the atmosphere in the house was laid back. Tiger could get used to that. After Woods left, Mark turned to Alicia.
"What did you think of him as a person?" he asked.
"I think he's an incredibly gifted kid," Alicia said.
"You really think so?"
"Absolutely." Mark didn't follow. Alicia, after all, hadn't seen Tiger play golf. How would she know whether he was gifted? But she hadn't been referring to golf when she said gifted. Alicia had served on a local board of education and had been around plenty of teenagers. Tiger seemed so much more mature than the other teenagers she knew. He looked her in the eye when he spoke. He had interesting things to say. He had great presence. He was unusually charismatic. There was something about him that made it impossible to look away from him. "But can he play golf?" Alicia asked. Mark raised his eyebrows and nodded. "This kid can play." When Tiger returned to Cyprus, he was officially old enough to drive. He put his golf bag in the back of his used Toyota Supra and drove to Dina Gravel's house. "You should come to the driving range with me," he told her. "What's that?" she said. He laughed. Suddenly she sounded like the innocent, naive one. Rather than explain, he told her to hop in. When they arrived at the Navy course, Tiger ran into Joe Groman. "Hi, champ," Groman said. Joe took one look at Gravel and knew that Tiger had ignored his advice. But inside he was smiling. The champ had gone from no girlfriend to a blonde bombshell. Typical Tiger, he thought. From 0 straight to 100 miles an hour. Groman welcomed Gravel to the course, and Tiger led her to the driving range where he teed up a ball and sent it sailing. "Whoa," she said, her head popping back with the sound of the club striking the ball. While he put on a display over the next 30 minutes, she kept repeating, "Whoa!" It was as if Tiger had ducked into a phone booth, removed his glasses, and emerged a superhero. His entire demeanor changed when he had a club in his hands. He walked with his head up. He stood taller. He brimmed with confidence. "Wow! Who is this guy?" she thought. At school, he was so quiet that he rarely spoke to fellow students. On the course, he was talking confidently with adults. Tiger took the time to explain things to her, the grip of the club, the trajectory of the ball, the placement of his feet. It was all very technical, but he made it understandable. He made it cool. "I just didn't think of golf as a sport," Gravel said. "I thought of it as a recreational activity for older people." Tiger couldn't help laughing at her. She was clueless when it came to golf, and she had no idea what his life was like outside of school. They both appreciated the sudden role reversal. At Western, she got a kick out of his unfamiliarity with the whole social scene. Now it was his turn to teach her a few things. The Navy course, he insisted, was nothing. It was just a place to practice. To really get a glimpse of his world, she needed to come to a tournament. "What goes on there?" she asked. "You'll see." He always felt nervous on the first tee, but this was different, more intense. As he reached into his bag and pulled out his driver, Tiger felt he had a sudden case of rigor mortis. He struggled to grip the club. "Breathe," he'd been taught. "Just breathe." It was Thursday morning, February 27, 1992, and Tiger should have been sitting in his geometry class at Western High in Anaheim. Instead,
He was 42 miles away on a cliff in Pacific Palisades, 70 feet above the first fairway at Rivera Country Club, preparing to tee off in the opening round of the Nissan Los Angeles Open. The first hole was 501 yards away, but that wasn't what had him anxious. He could always handle distance. Great expectations were his burden, and at that moment, the expectations were greater than ever, and this was his first PGA Tour event. Barely 2 months past his 16th birthday, he was the youngest player to ever appear in a tour event. The other 143 golfers were pros. An army of journalists, photographers, and television cameramen were on hand. They were all there to see him. Spectators lined up six deep around the tee. Wearing a white cap, a short-sleeved striped shirt, and pleated pants, Tiger swung, launching his ball over the cliff. With the sun shining on him, the 6'1", 140-pound high school sophomore stood like a statue, his hips open, his spine twisted, his club behind him. He held his form until his ball dropped from the sky 280 yards away. A collective roar echoed from the crowd. Trailed by security guards, Tiger immediately started walking toward the fairway, television cameras in his path. The bodyguards added another element to the circus atmosphere swirling around Tiger. They had been assigned to him after tournament chairman Mark Cooperstock had exercised his right under what's known as a sponsor exemption to invite someone, in this case Tiger, who hadn't qualified for the tournament to participate. As a result, Cooperstock received an anonymous call from a man who didn't like the fact that the tournament had given an exemption to a nigger. Tiger also received a death threat, but the fans lining the fairway adored him. "You the kid!" one fan shouted in a variation of the usual cry of, "You the man!" "He's the next Jack Nicklaus, maybe better," another spectator said. "There walks the future of American golf," said another. His nervousness dissipated and he shot 72 on the day, finishing one over par and eight shots behind the leader. He would end up missing the cut, but by the end of the second day, every pro knew Tiger Woods was the real deal. Golf writers ignored the leaderboard in order to talk to him. Fans adored him. People wanted pictures, autographs, a chance to touch him. It felt so invigorating to be the center of attention. He could do no wrong. Dina Gravel didn't know what to say. Walking the course with Cultida had been a surreal experience. What had happened to that nerdy kid she had first encountered 5 months earlier in an accounting class? With a golf club in his hand, Tiger looked so invincible, so strong. Flashing a magnetic smile, he faced network television cameras and zoom lenses from Sports Illustrated with confidence. He never flinched as distinguished men, attractive women, teenagers, and little kids shouted his name. Wayne's World was the number one movie in the country that week, but Gravel came to the sudden realization that Tiger's World was more exciting than anything Hollywood could dream up, and so much bigger than anything going on in the hallways at Western High, where the so-called cool kids looked at him as just that golf guy. To the rest of the world, Tiger Woods was the man. After he finished his final round, Tiger was eager to talk to Gravel, but first he had to talk to Sports Illustrated. "I think these were the best 2 days of my life," he told the magazine. "I really do. Even when I hit a bad shot, people clapped." 3 days later, Tiger led the Western High golf team in its season opener against Gar High in Cerritos. There was no press, no crowd, not even his parents or Gravel were there to watch. Tiger dominated, but it was pretty anticlimactic after playing in a PGA Tour event. High school, on many levels, limited his creativity. He was made for a much bigger stage. Afterward, he went to Gravel's house, where her parents greeted him with hugs and high praise. They had followed the LA Open in the paper and on the local news. Plus, Dina hadn't stopped talking about it for the past 3 days. Tiger loved being around the Gravels and the way they so easily showed affection. They were always like that, and he wasn't used to it. His home had a much colder feel. There was no embracing, and words of affection were seldom exchanged between his parents or given to him. That was one reason Tiger preferred hanging out at Dina's place to bringing her to his house. Once Tiger and Dina were alone, she said she'd been thinking about something since seeing him play. The simplest way to say it was that the Tiger she knew at high school wasn't the Tiger she saw at the tournament. One walked with his head down, rarely talked, and appeared socially awkward. The other was confident, strong, and in control. He seemed like two different people. Tiger had never heard that from anyone, and he wasn't sure what to say in response. She had essentially challenged him to ask himself, "Who am I?" It was a question that required some serious introspection, and he could tell that she wanted him to share his feelings. But he wasn't comfortable doing that. He didn't even know how to do that. One of the unspoken rules in his family was that they didn't reveal or share emotions with one another. His parents simply didn't talk to each other or to him about their feelings, about matters of the heart, or about any subject that required them to open up. Tiger would later describe this as one of our deals of being a woods. Rather than trying to explain any of this to Dina, he simply avoided her observation, preferring instead to contemplate a more comfortable subject, his future. It looked like a big open road, and he couldn't wait to get on it. For the first time, however, he was considering the prospect of having someone along for the journey. Dina had cared about him as a person before she'd known that he was talented and famous. She was also the first person who had shown him physical affection. He wasn't yet ready to open up to her, but he wanted her at his side.
Chapter 6. The Next Level. John Merchant was used to calling the shots. The 60-year-old lawyer wore dapper suits, sat on the board of directors of Connecticut's largest bank, and had recently been appointed by the governor to head the state's Office of Consumer Counsel. From behind his desk at the state capitol in Hartford, he directed multiple divisions of state attorneys. But on a picture-perfect day in late July 1993, Merchant was on a golf course in Portland, Oregon, some 3,000 miles from home. Wearing khaki pants and a short-sleeved golf shirt that accentuated his white mustache and graying, neatly trimmed afro, he emerged unnoticed from the field house at Waverly Country Club. It was the first day of the U.S. Junior Amateur Championship, and the normally serene setting was bustling with people. Stopping to survey the pristine grounds, Merchant couldn't help grinning and asking himself, "How did I get here?" It was a journey that had begun 3 years earlier when golf faced a moral crisis sparked by Hall W. Thompson, a prominent Alabama businessman who had built the Shoal Creek Golf and Country Club near Birmingham. Shoal Creek was chosen to host the PGA Championship in August 1990. But in June of that year, Thompson had talked to a reporter at the Birmingham Post-Herald who asked about Shoal Creek's membership policy. It welcomed Jews and women, but excluded blacks. "We don't discriminate in every other area except the blacks," Thompson said. His answer prompted an immediate backlash. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference threatened to picket the tournament. Corporate sponsors such as IBM pulled more than $2 million in commercial advertising from the television broadcast. Newspapers and media outlets throughout the country started looking into membership policies. The Charlotte Observer published a report indicating that 17 golf clubs that were host sites for PGA Tour events had all-white memberships. And another published report suggested that 3 out of 4 of America's private golf clubs had membership policies similar to Shoal Creek's. After insisting he'd been misquoted, Thompson nonetheless apologized. But by that point, the PGA Tour had found itself at the center of a fast-moving firestorm over racism. The president of the USGA, Grant Spaeth, acknowledged that the organization routinely held championship tournaments at clubs that prohibited black membership. "So, however distressing one finds this firestorm," Spaeth told the New York Times, "I conclude without question that open debate and decision-making is long overdue, and we are thus provided the opportunity to sort things out fully and fairly." In 1991, in the aftermath of Shoal Creek, John Merchant received an unexpected phone call from S. Giles Payne, a Connecticut lawyer who had long been involved with the USGA. Merchant and Payne were old friends and occasional golfing partners, but it had been a few years since they had spoken. Payne cut to the chase, asking Merchant if he had any interest in joining the USGA's executive committee. Flattered, Merchant laughed and admitted that he wasn't really sure what the executive committee was or did. Payne explained that it was the USGA's 16-member governing body, responsible for setting the rules of golf and regulating the equipment used throughout America and Mexico, Seats on the committee were highly coveted and typically went to individuals with wealth and influence. Merchant was intrigued. He wasn't that wealthy, and his sphere of influence was limited to legal and banking circles in Connecticut. But he knew the deal. The bottom line was that in its 97-year history, the USGA had never had an African-American on its executive committee. Shoal Creek had made it embarrassingly clear that the leadership needed to diversify. The executive committee was seeking a person of color, and Merchant seemed ideal. He had been the first black to graduate from the University of Virginia's law school back in 1958. He was the first, and at the time only, person of color to become a member of the highly executive Country Club of Fairfield in Connecticut. And he was the first black to serve on the board of directors at Connecticut's largest bank. He also happened to be a very good golfer. The process of vetting, formal nomination, and approval took more than a year, but by 1993, Merchant was in place. He had just one concern. "I don't want anybody at the USGA to think that I'm a fucking token," he said. Despite his government obligations as Connecticut's chief lawyer for consumers, Merchant determined that he would go to as many junior golf events as possible to get up to speed in his new role. The Junior Amateur in Portland was the first. Unfamiliar with the course, he decided to look around. His first observation was that there were no people of color in sight. Then he spotted a black man sitting at a table beneath an umbrella on a patio just off the course. Merchant approached, and the man looked up from his drink. "I'm John Merchant. I'm with the USGA Executive Committee," Merchant said. "Earl Woods," the stranger said. "Sit down." Moments later, a waiter appeared. "I'll have what he's drinking," Merchant said, nodding at Woods. The two men spent the next hour getting acquainted. Earl said that his son was in the tournament, but he never specifically mentioned Tiger's name, nor did Merchant make the connection that Earl's son was Tiger. Instead, the conversation focused largely on race and golf. Woods was impressed with Merchant's accomplishments in academia, law, banking, and business. He also made a mental note that Merchant was a 2-time club champion in Connecticut. Always on the hunt for anyone who could help advance Tiger's career, Earl had yet to come across a black man who was as smart, accomplished, and good at golf as John Merchant. They exchanged phone numbers and agreed to stay in touch. Tiger ended up winning the tournament, coming from behind in dramatic fashion to defeat Ryan Armour by making birdies on his final two holes. It was his third U.S. junior amateur victory and his 18th consecutive victory in junior amateur matches, boosting him to a 22-1 match play record in 4 U.S. juniors. By the time Tiger walked off with the trophy, John Merchant had put 2 and 2 together. The man he'd sipped drinks with was Tiger's father. When he got back to Connecticut, Merchant telephoned Earl and congratulated him on his son's remarkable achievement. Earl insisted that they meet at the next tournament, and Merchant agreed. They had a lot more to talk about. Throughout his junior year of high school, Tiger was inundated with scholarship offers. Every top program in the country wanted him. But after visiting UNLV, he came away convinced that Las Vegas was the place for him. He loved the facilities and the climate. The campus was close enough to home, roughly 270 miles away, that he could drive there in less than 5 hours. Plus, the city had a great vibe. For him, it seemed like the ideal place to go to school. His parents, however, were dead set on Stanford. Academically, the university was right up there with Harvard and Yale, which was important to Cultita. And from a golf perspective, Stanford had one of the top programs in the country. Everyone, including Stanford's head coach, Wally Goodman, assumed Tiger was going to go to Stanford. Dina Gravel was one person Tiger felt comfortable talking to about his dilemma. They had become inseparable, and she had chosen to remain at home for her freshman year of college, enrolling at Cypress Community College, to remain with Tiger during his senior year of high school. He told her that he wanted to go to UNLV, but he didn't want to go against his parents or the plan. Little by little, Tiger had been opening up to Dina, hinting at some of the pressures he felt at home. Gravel wasn't surprised. She'd seen enough to know that Tiger's upbringing had been very different from hers and more difficult. One time, they'd been out having some mischievous fun with friends, toilet papering houses in the neighborhood, and when they reached Tiger's house, Cultita scolded him in public. "What were you thinking?" Cultita said in a stern voice as Tiger's friends looked on. Then there was Earl, who was constantly singing Tiger's praises to the press, building him up. Gravel didn't want to complicate things.
Whatever you decide, she told him, we'll get through it. Tiger faced another big decision, whom to turn to for a swing coach. Earlier in the year, John Anselmo had been diagnosed with colon cancer and was forced to take a break from teaching while undergoing treatment. Tiger had worked with him for 7 years. During that time, he had won his record-setting 3 straight U.S. junior amateur titles, established himself as the top high school golfer in the state of California, and become the most dominant junior golfer in the country. Anselmo hoped to resume coaching Tiger once he regained his strength, but Earl had already been thinking that his son needed someone else to prepare him for turning pro, and he had a specific person in mind. Claude Harmon Jr., known simply as Butch on the PGA Tour, had golfing royalty in his blood. His father, Eugene Claude Harmon Sr., won the Masters in 1948. Butch went on to become the director of golf at Lochinvar Golf Club, an exclusive all-male club in Houston. He was also Greg Norman's swing coach, and in 1993, Norman had the smoothest swing on the PGA Tour. While Tiger was in Houston to compete in his first U.S. amateur in August 1993, he paid a visit to Lochinvar. Its relatively small membership included former President George H.W. Bush, gas and oil barons, CEOs, and a number of pro athletes. At Harmon's invitation, Tiger agreed to put on a little exhibition. For Tiger, it was more like an audition. Millionaires who owned private planes, oil rigs, and ranches the size of Rhode Island stopped and admired as Tiger shaped shots around trees with precision and launched golf balls more than 300 yards through the air. His raw talent and creativity impressed Harmon, but it was the speed and power of Tiger's swing that left the most lasting impression. The adjective that came to mind was violent. Tiger swung so violently that he had raw spots on his forearm from the friction created by their rubbing together on his release. "What's your go-to shot when you aren't swinging well?" Harmon asked. Tiger shrugged and kept hammering shots off the tee. "Swing as fast as I can, unleash everything I have through the ball," he said. "Then I go find the ball and hit it again." In other words, Harmon realized, Tiger didn't have one particular shot that he relied on when he really needed to place his ball in a specific location. No three-quarter shots, no knockdown shots, no punch shots, just power. Yet he'd won 3 straight U.S. juniors, clearly demonstrating that he knew how to score and how to win. It was almost frightening to contemplate how lethal Tiger would be when he added an array of finesse shots to his repertoire. The following night, Earl telephoned Harmon from his home in Cyprus and asked a direct question. "Will you help take Tiger to the next level?" Harmon had been hoping Earl would ask. For the previous 24 hours, all he'd been able to think about was the prospect of coaching Tiger. He told Earl he was in, and he agreed to waive his $300 an hour fee. "I know you guys don't have any money, so I'm not going to charge you anything," Harmon told Earl. "But when the day comes, and he turns pro and becomes a superstar, and I'm sure he will, I'll send you a bill." "Deal," Earl said. Tiger was on the same page with his father when it came to hiring Harmon, but he wasn't talking to Earl or his mother about college. Discussion in the Woods home was so rare that even Tiger's parents didn't know which way he was leaning. Cultita placed an urgent call to Wally Goodman and hinted that he should make a last-ditch home visit. Goodman assured her that wasn't necessary. "I think Tiger and I have cleared up every question," he told her. "Well, you better come down," she said. Goodman didn't like the sound of that. A couple of nights later, he showed up at Tiger's home. Tiger said nothing as Goodman joined the family for an informal pizza dinner at a card table that was set up in the living room. The atmosphere was awkward, to say the least. With Earl and Cultita struggling to make small talk, the meal felt more like a funeral than a social dinner. Finally, Tiger looked at Goodman with a somber expression. "Coach, I have something for you," he said. Then he reached under his chair and retrieved the UNLV golf hat. "Tiger, what are you doing?" Goodman said. Looking him in the eye, Tiger said nothing.
"You didn't ask me to come all the way down here to show me that hat, did you?" Goodman continued.
Tiger reached under his chair and pulled out a USC golf hat. Goodman wasn't amused. "Okay, Tiger," he said, wiping his mouth and getting up from the table. "No, coach," Tiger said. "Wait." Perturbed, Goodman paused while Tiger reached under his chair and retrieved a third hat. It was red and had an S on it.
Without saying a word, he put it on. Days later, on November 10th, 1993, Tiger made it official, signing his letter of intent to attend Stanford. He told the press that it was a straightforward decision. "The reason I chose Stanford is to better myself as a person," he said. "There's more to life than just playing golf and hitting this little white ball around. My family's always raised me that way. School has always been the number one priority in our family." Privately, he rationalized his decision to Dina. "I don't know how long I'm going to be in college anyway," Tiger told her. "I guess I can just suck it up wherever I go for a while." Tiger took Dina to his senior prom, but it felt different from when they'd gone to her prom the previous year. In many ways, things had changed. Tiger no longer passed unnoticed through the hallways of Western High. His circle of friends hadn't expanded, but everyone respected and admired him. His classmates even voted him most likely to succeed. Everything seemed to be falling into place for him. After graduating with a 3.8 GPA, he was immediately going on the road for the summer to play in amateur tournaments. Then in the fall, it was off to Stanford on a full-ride scholarship. After that, he would be on the PGA Tour. His life was already neatly mapped out. There were no stop signs, no red lights, no speed limits. Dina's situation was much more tenuous. She was still living at home, working a minimum wage job, and attending community college. It felt like she was stuck in neutral, especially when she compared herself to Tiger. But they never talked about her future. Tiger figured she would simply go where he went. But Dina was never comfortable with the spotlight that was always on him. She seldom went to his tournaments because she didn't like the environment. Besides, she couldn't get near him. He was always inside the ropes, and she was lost in the crowd. She couldn't help wondering if she was really cut out for the life that awaited Tiger. Shortly after Woods graduated, Dina told him that she had decided to move to Las Vegas. Her aunt lived there and had offered her a room until she sorted out her future. If nothing else, she needed to get away from Cyprus for a while. Tiger didn't understand. He wanted Dina to remain in Southern California, but Dina didn't see the point. It wasn't as if Tiger was going to be around. He was leaving for college in Palo Alto at the end of the summer. In the interim, he would be on the amateur circuit. Either way, they were going to be apart. "If we really love each other," she told him, "we'll come back to each other." John Merchant reveled in the distinction of being the first black member on the USGA's executive committee. It gave him a platform to advance his favorite cause, minority participation in golf. Merchant had spent most of his adult life being the only African-American on the courses he played, and he would often wonder how to change the situation. His position with the USGA finally afforded him an avenue to help introduce more inner-city youth to the game he had grown to love. It also didn't hurt that word of his personal connection to Earl and Tiger Woods was starting to get around. In the year since he'd met Earl Woods, he had become like a godfather to Tiger. They had played plenty of rounds of golf together, and Tiger liked to pick Merchant's brain on a range of topics outside of golf. They even traveled together when Tiger played in amateur tournaments. Merchant was under the impression that Earl and Tiger had the best father-son relationship he had ever witnessed. They could finish each other's sentences. Recognizing that Merchant had a lot to offer, Earl increasingly turned to him for advice. All of this put a little swagger in Merchant's step at the State Consumer Council's office in Hartford and at the Country Club of Fairfield, where he liked to brag about Tiger, who spent the summer of 1994 on a tear, winning the Pacific Northwest Amateur, the Southern California Amateur, and the Western Amateur. While Merchant reveled in the ride, a staff attorney in his office at the state capitol filed an ethics complaint against him, accusing him of using his state office to conduct USGA business, specifically, attending golf tournaments on state time. The Office of State Ethics and the Office of the Auditors of Public Accounts launched an investigation, which turned up evidence linking Merchant to Earl Woods. Tiger likely knew nothing about Merchant's ethics probe or that his name had surfaced in it. During the summer of 1994, he was preoccupied by a far more devastating discovery. His father had cheated on his mother. Earl had been unfaithful to Cultita for years. Young women would call the house and ask to speak with Earl about private golf lessons. Cultita knew what was going on. Although she and Earl hadn't been intimate in a long time, she remained married to Earl for Tiger's sake.
Earl's womanizing was well known to his extended family. His own sister May, who loved Earl dearly, famously quipped, "Oh, Lord, if he had been my husband, I'd have shot him." Earl was actually proud of the way he behaved around women and called himself a player, not a cheater. From all signs, he wasn't ashamed of it, Tom Callahan said. In fact, he was proud enough of his playing equipment, justifiably, that if he knew who was at the front door, he didn't mind coming straight from the shower, naked. Cultita had thus far managed to keep all of this from Tiger, but Earl had secrets that even Cultita didn't know about, some of which were aggravated by his vices. Alcohol, tobacco, and pornography. His habits drove a wedge between him and his family. On Tiger's 17th birthday, the family celebrated by going out for dinner. Some of Cultita's relatives joined the festivities, which amounted to an evening of celebrating Tiger's many achievements and his future. Earl had driven his own car to the restaurant. When everyone headed home, he made a pit stop at a convenience store, emerging with a brown paper bag containing a bottle of Colt 45 and a porno magazine, both of which he consumed alone. But when Earl retired and began accompanying Tiger to tournaments around the country, it became harder and harder to hide his ways. Tiger soon figured out what was going on. The family creed was to say nothing. Part of being a Woods was keeping secrets all in the family. But eventually, Tiger couldn't take it anymore. One night, he picked up the phone and called Gravel in Las Vegas. Sobbing, he revealed that his father, his idol, had been unfaithful. Struggling to elaborate, he just cried. In a series of calls that stretched over a period of weeks, Tiger continued to lean on Gravel for support. He was conflicted over his relationship with his father. He loved him and considered him his best friend, yet he hated some of the things he did. The outspoken comments and grandiose predictions about Tiger's future were embarrassing enough, but Tiger particularly disdained the way that his father had treated his mother. Tiger wanted them to be a family, but he was coming to the realization that they were never going to be one in the traditional sense. Gravel finally gave him some advice. "You can't live with these secrets and this pressure," she told him. "You need to have a conversation with your dad. You need to figure out what you really want." Tiger had finally opened up to Gravel, but opening up to his father was out of the question. They could talk about golf and sports and other mundane subjects, but not about matters of the heart. That just wasn't done. Tiger was loath to share anything personal about himself with the press, including his goals. He had a lengthy list of them, but his silence on the subject would eventually lead to what he described as a major misconception by the media, that his primary goal was to win more championships than Jack Nicklaus. Nicklaus's 18 major championships, however, were not Woods's primary focus. It was his age, not numbers, that mattered most to Tiger. It was the first time he broke 40, the first time he broke 80, the first golf tournament he ever won, first time he ever won the state amateur, first time he won the U.S. amateur, and the first time he won the U.S. Open, Tiger explained on the eve of his 40th birthday. That was it. That was the list. It was all age-related. To me, that was important. This guy's the best out there and the best of all time. If I can beat each age that he did it, then I have a chance at being the best. One of the goals on Tiger's list, to become the youngest player ever to win the U.S. amateur, was front and center at the end of the summer of 1994. Nicklaus had won it when he was a 19-year-old junior at Ohio State University in 1959. Tiger was determined to win the U.S. amateur as an 18-year-old yet to enter college. He'd spent a year working with Butch Harmon, dialing down his swing a bit and learning to hit the ball pin high. "Butchie harped at me to understand how to hit the ball pin high," Woods explained. "That didn't mean flag high. Pin high meant whatever you decided was your number, not necessarily where the flag was. If the flag was 164 yards, maybe I'd want to make sure my ball carried 160 yards to keep it short of the hole and leave myself an uphill putt." The long hours Tiger put in with Harmon made him a much more complete golfer and much harder to beat. Yet as the final round wore on at the TPC at Sawgrass in Pontevedra Beach, Florida on August 24, 1994, Tiger appeared destined to come up short in his age-related quest to beat Big Jack. With just 13 holes to play, he trailed 22-year-old Ernest W. Keeney III, otherwise known as Tripp, by 6 holes. In order to win, Tiger would have to mount the greatest comeback in U.S. amateur history. But when Tiger looked at Keeney, he saw more than an opponent. He saw an enemy. A two-time state champion in high school, Keeney had roomed with Phil Mickelson at Arizona State during his freshman year before transferring to Oklahoma State, where he became an All-American. He was an aspiring pro who didn't know what it was like to be hungry. One year earlier, when Tiger had participated in the Byron Nelson Classic in Dallas, he and Earl had stayed with Keeney at his family's home in Texas. It dwarfed the Woods' tiny ranch house in Cypress, and being there for a few days demonstrated what Earl had always preached, that golf was a game played by privileged white people. Tripp's father, Ernest II, was a prominent attorney who owned two banks and was CEO of an oil company. He made a point of taking Earl and Tiger to see the facility where Tripp and his other two children received private golf lessons from an instructor named Hank Haney. Tiger had little interest in meeting Haney or seeing the facility. He was aware that there were fundamental differences between him and Tripp, starting with the way they had learned to play the game, and he didn't like having it rubbed in his face. Neither did Earl. Toward the end of the stay, Tripp's father asked Earl, "How can you afford to do all this stuff as a retired military guy?" It infuriated Earl, who took it as an insinuation that a black man couldn't keep up. Tripp Keeney had learned golf the traditional way, through years of membership at a country club. His father really wanted him to be a pro and pushed him hard in that direction, but Tripp had plenty of other options and advantages. The finest schools, financial backing, connections. If golf didn't work out, he would do just fine in finance or business. Tiger, on the other hand, had learned to play on public courses, and his biggest influence was his father, whose very unorthodox methods instilled in him a killer instinct, a mean streak, of the sort that one might expect to find in a boxer. His father was no CEO. His mother was an immigrant from a distant land. His family had little money and few connections. Their only real chance for upward mobility rested squarely on Tiger's golf game. So at the U.S. Amateur at Pontevedra Beach, Tiger wasn't just out there to beat Tripp Keeney. He wanted to beat everything Tripp stood for. He wanted to prove to the country club set that he was better than them. With his father, John Merchant, and Butch Harmon looking on, Tiger chipped away at Keeney's lead on the back nine, playing more aggressively on each hole as Keeney became increasingly tentative. With two holes left to play, they were all square, and what had seemed impossible 10 holes earlier suddenly seemed inevitable as Tiger stepped to the tee on the famed 17th hole. Facing the most intimidating par 3 in the world, an iconic island green surrounded by water and connected to the course by a long, narrow neck of grass, Tiger chose the highest risk shot imaginable. With 139 yards to the hole, he aimed straight for the pin and hit a towering tee shot that landed just to the right of the flag and bounced into the rough, seemingly on its way into the water. But the groans from the gallery turned to euphoric cheers as the ball inexplicably spun back and eased to a stop 2 feet from the water's edge and 14 feet from the cup. By the time the cheering had stopped, Tiger was on the island green, standing over the ball with the water at his back. Only the sound of a distant great egret broke the silence as his putter tapped the ball, sending it arcing toward the cup. Initially frozen still, Tiger clenched his fist and started skipping to his left even before the ball dropped into the cup. Then he punched the sky with a vigorous uppercut. "Yeah!" he yelled, his feet shuffling left to right. It was a defining moment. Tiger Woods, putter in his left hand, right arm bent at the elbow to form a perfect L shape, clenched his fist as his white shoes glided over the silky green turf. He had pulled ahead of Keeney for the first time all day. One hole still remained, but Tiger knew it was over, and he knew that Keeney knew it too. Moments later, he stood over Keeney's shoulder as the All-American missed a 4-foot putt on the 18th hole. Woods won 2 up. Tiger had beaten Nicklaus's record as the youngest U.S. amateur champion, and he'd done it by mounting the greatest comeback in tournament history. And he was the first African-American ever to win the tournament. The promise of greatness was beginning to take hold. "It's just the start," Earl boasted. Tiger had already picked up the trophy, and Earl was already talking to a reporter from People magazine. "I've seen him accomplish these things his entire life," he continued, "since the age of 8. He's been the number one golfer in the world.
He's still the same old Tiger and will always be. But when he gets a little cocky, I say, you weren't shit before, you aren't shit now, and you'll never be shit.
After transcribing his interview, the People reporter transmitted it to his editor, who decided not to print the quotations from Earl. Instead, those controversial statements ended up in a thick manila file labeled Tiger Woods. The omission of Earl's statements from the public record helped preserve the budding image of him as a father who was selflessly dedicated to his son's happiness and success. Fortunately for Tiger, the media had no appetite for probing what was behind Earl's outlandish statements and focused instead on Tiger's remarkable victory at the U.S. Amateur. His achievement landed him on the front page of the New York Times and USA Today. Sports Illustrated dubbed him the Comeback Kid. Jay Leno and David Letterman wanted him on their shows. Even President Bill Clinton sent him a congratulatory letter. Back home, Cyprus presented Tiger with a key to the city. The ceremony took place at the Cyprus Golf Club, where Tiger addressed a crowd of local dignitaries. "This thing tonight is unbelievable," he told them. "Here I am, only 18 years old, and I'm getting a key to the city? I'm very fortunate to have the city of Cyprus do something like this for me. I've been very fortunate to have great parents who love me to death." But not everyone back home was happy for Tiger. His burgeoning celebrity status rubbed a few people the wrong way, especially at the Navy course where he'd practiced throughout his youth and had enjoyed special privileges. For years, assistant pro Joe Groman had been quietly allowing Tiger and Earl to golf for free, and they were given golf carts and offered tokens for range balls without paying as well. These were the perks that came with being revered, but some members of management began to resent them. According to Groman, a couple of weeks before the U.S. Amateur, Tiger received a letter from the course manager outlining numerous complaints from members and informing him that he would be required to start carrying a receipt for his green fees on him at all times and to provide it upon request. Shocked, Tiger told Groman he couldn't believe some members had complained. Neither did Groman. He believed the club and course manager simply made up the letter to make Tiger feel unwelcome. Things finally came to a head about a week after Tiger won the U.S. Amateur. He was in his customary spot on the far side of the practice range one afternoon when Groman approached on a golf cart. "Hey, champ," he said, "have you seen any guys out here hitting balls into the neighborhood?" "Yeah, I saw a couple of guys," Tiger replied. "They walked down past the maintenance shed." Tiger didn't think much of it as Groman sped off in that direction. He was unaware that moments earlier, a woman had called the pro shop and complained to Groman about golf balls being launched from the course into her neighborhood. A few minutes after Joe drove off, Tiger was interrupted again, this time by the cart manager. With little explanation, he kicked Tiger off the course. Livid, Tiger gathered his equipment and headed home. When Groman returned to the pro shop after unsuccessfully searching for the culprits, he encountered the other assistant pro in tears. He told Groman that the cart manager had thrown Tiger off the course. Pissed, Groman confronted the guy, a Marine. "What did you do?" he demanded. "A neighbor lady called and said, a black kid is hitting balls into the houses, so I kicked him out." "Bullshit," Groman yelled. "I took that fucking phone call." Tiger was in the kitchen with his parents when Groman showed up at the front door. Earl invited him in, and after listening to Cultita rail, Groman offered to place a call to an African-American three-star general, a club member who was in command at the nearby naval base. "No," Earl told him, "that won't be necessary." "Goddamn Navy," Cultita said. "Fuck the Navy. We don't need the Navy." Nothing unified Earl and Cultita like the sense that their son had been slighted. "I was prepared to identify the Navy course as the place where Tiger grew up playing," Earl said. "They forfeited that right." Tiger didn't say a word. In 2 weeks, he was heading to Stanford. It was time to move on.
Chapter 7. The Amateur. Of Earl's three children from his first marriage, Tiger had the best relationship with Earl's daughter, Royce. In the fall of 1994, Royce was 36 years old and living in Cupertino, not far from the Stanford campus. A few days before Tiger was due to arrive in Palo Alto, he called her. "You still want your house?" he said. She immediately started laughing. Back when he was 3 years old, Tiger had promised to buy her a house when he became rich. Every couple of years, Royce would jokingly remind him of his commitment, but it had been quite a while since she'd last teased him about it.
Yeah?
She said jokingly. Well, then, could you do my laundry for 4 years? Tiger asked. She laughed again, but he wasn't joking.